Historical Hot or Not will be doing a live recording. At the Edinburgh Fringe Festival. That will be on the 22nd of August 2023, the year that we're in now, at 12:30. I want to say AM, it's PM though. The midday one, not the midnight one. It'll be part of the podcast hour.
And that episode will be recorded as part of Laughing Horse at the City Cafe. There is a link to the day we are recording. Each day is a different podcast being recorded. We will only be there on the 22nd. And the ticket link in our Hot Not Pod link tree, which is available on Instagram and Twitter, has a link directly to the day we are recording.
I will also be doing my Edinburgh show, my debut, at the Edinburgh Fringe Festival. My show is called Scream Inside Your Heart, and it will be at the Three Sisters in the Wee Room at 12 noon, 12 midday, not midnight, and that will be on from the 3rd to the 20th of August.
They might be a Viking or a Saxon or a Roman, but tell me, do you like them? Would you sex them? Would you bone them? Would you go to bed with King Ethelred? Would you bonk William the Conqueror up in the sheets with Samuel Pepys? Mussolini was a meanie, led a fascist insurrection, but does he make you creamy? Does he give you an erection? Would you pork Richard the Duke of York? Does a boner start when you think of Bonaparte? Are you sexually aroused at the thought of Pol Pot? Historical Hot or Not?
Hello, and welcome to Historical Hot or Not, the only podcast that blasts the Arizona desert of history with the nuclear radiation of cum jokes. I don't know why I decided to do this opening sequence in the style of a local radio DJ, but there we go. My name is Ed McCaffrey. I am not a historian, and this is
Catherine Mather, and I am also not a historian or a radio DJ, but we are comedians and we are horny for history. Are you feeling particularly horny for this one today, Aidan?
Sort of, actually. It's an interesting subject, today's episode, because he's not someone you would associate with sexual virility. You know, we're not doing Caligula today or Henry VIII. But actually, when you get into his life, he was a very sexually active man.
Okay.
A surprise considering his temperament.
Good for him.
But before we get into that, Kath, this is the first episode we have recorded in ages that is just us.
It is, isn't it?
From the listener's perspective, this is episode 3 of season 3, but actually it's the last episode we have recorded for this, and every other single one of that season has had a big name guest in it.
It has.
It's weird. It's just us. It's the old gang back together.
Yeah.
One more for old time's sake.
I hope we're not too disappointing now that it's just the two of us.
Yeah, and we realise we really need those people. In an hour, we'll be like, Ignacio, Rachel, please come back on the pod. We're nothing without you.
Yeah, we did also meet. This is the second time I've seen you this week, and it is only Tuesday. You came to watch one of my shows, didn't you, last night?
I did indeed. As has been documented on this pod before, Kath and I, most of our relationship is through this pod.
Yes.
I'm still sort of not quite at the point where when I meet you in the flesh, I don't find it weird that we're not talking on Zoom or Riverside or some kind of video conferencing thing. It's always slightly surreal. But I'll tell you what wasn't surreal was your preview you did, Kath, of your Edinburgh show, Scream Inside Your Heart, which was well attended and it was very funny and it went down very well with the crowd. And surely you must now be feeling very confident about your upcoming Edinburgh hour. Is that true?
Yeah, I am feeling pretty good about the show. Feels like it's coming together. I'll be honest with you as well, Aidan. I am always surprised when we meet up with how hairy your chest is. Unless you're just wearing like some fur collar and the rest of you is smooth as the bonnet of a Porsche.
Can I say it as a testament to how hairy I am? I am wearing a button-up shirt that is buttoned right to the top. Mm-hmm. And Kath can still see how hairy my chest is. Mm-hmm. Because the rug beneath cannot but help itself but creep over the top.
It's like you've shoved a little hamster down there. Or
or a big cat. I think this is the first time we've done a pod where one of us, in this case me, has arguably dressed up as the subject he's talking about. Because I'm pretty much wearing what, spoiler alert, J. Robert Oppenheimer would have worn while he was at work, but not while he was making love.
How do you know, Aiden? How do you know he wasn't wearing a full suit while he was making love?
Actually, I don't. And to be honest, when we discover the full details of his life, because he's a very serious, introverted, almost spectrum-y man, wouldn't surprise me if he had the full suit on while he was banging one of his many women. Before we get to that, I do have a funny anecdote that I've been meaning to tell you for months. Basically, the story I'm about to tell is like the most middle-class thing you're ever likely to hear, which is we recorded a podcast and we both did our bit, and there's a bit where you say, go now to ko-fi.hotnotpod, and that's like kind of more or less exactly how you said it. I basically spent about half an hour trying to clip the T off you saying hot and then add it on to you saying not in an attempt to basically correct how you speak. Basically, it was sort of like the podcast equivalent of Pygmalion or My Fair Lady, where I was trying to turn you into something proper. And you know what, Kath? In the end, I gave up and I never released that advert. Although that wasn't because, I didn't not release the advert because of that, but I did give up trying to make you sound like someone who pronounces T's.
I mean, you could have just texted me and I would have literally just spoken it into WhatsApp for you.
But no, I decided to make it as hard as possible for myself. You think it would be easy because hot, not. It's actually the same phonetic sound, but there was something about it. It always sounded artificial.
Hot, not pod, isn't it?
I'll never make you into a classy woman, Kath, sadly.
Hell no. The format of this glorious podcast is each week, each episode, whatever interval these episodes are delivered in, either Aiden or myself will pitch a potential suitor from history to one another from the eTroth dating app, the historical dating app that we have definitely not just made up for the purposes of this podcast. We'll begin by taking a look at them physically and deciding whether we would objectify them, whether we would fuck them. Then we find out a little bit about them, and once we've done that, we go for the overall yes, no. Would we bang them? If it's a yes, they'll end up on the beer year tap tapestry. If not, well, they can do the walk of shame home. Aiden, this is your episode. Who have you got for me? And I'm going to act surprised as though we haven't already mentioned his name twice.
This Kath, as you're about to see on your eTroth app, is Julius. He is 62 and he is from New York.
Oh, I mean, he's not unattractive. He's got quite an angular face, I think. Quite a small head. Quite nondescript, really. And I don't mean that in a nasty way. It's just, it is difficult to pick out features, defining features to describe him. Just short, dark hair, suit, quite small lips. Looks to have dark eyes. It's a black and white photograph. Small earlobes. I'm looking at these ears thinking that'd be difficult to get them pierced.
Is that a prerequisite of all your lovers, that they have to have a hole punctured through a lobe?
yeah, exactly. I mean, sure, yeah, I guess.
This is what I like about doing the podcast with you, Kath. You don't need to be massively enthused about a potential lover to say yes. Just like, yeah. You've literally sometimes acknowledged that a person is very dislikable, like in the Theodore Roosevelt episode, but then gone, but sure, why not?
Well, I mean, there's a difference, isn't there, between a quick bang and a potential lifelong suitor, isn't there? You've not said I've got to marry him.
That's true. The barrier for entry onto the Bayo Tap Latistry, very low, exceptionally low.
Yeah.
Just be a bit hot and try not to kill too many people. That's kind of it. That's kind of it.
Yeah. We are who we are. Aren't we?
Exactly.
To quote, I think that might be Kesha.
What the Quim wants.
What do you think of this guy?
Based solely on this photo, he's got quite magnetic eyes, I think. Very serious looking. But, yeah. And I don't know, maybe I am reading stuff in that I know about him, but he's sort of got those burrowing eyes. I suspect if he's fixated on something, he's very fixated. So you can imagine how you could be drawn into him. He looks like the kind of guy who would really hold your gaze while you're having a conversation. and then you'd end up banging him.
Yeah, you'd be like, hold on a minute. Are we? Oh yeah, we are banging. Okay.
When did that happen? Holy shit, we got a whole bus ride home? I don't remember any of that. I was too busy lost in your weirdly serious eyes.
Yeah, from a superficial standpoint, I'm going to say yes.
As we know, as Hot Not Pod fans know, that is not where it ends. We have to delve into the life of said person.
Can you imagine if that's how it ended? Can you imagine if that's, that was all the podcast? Would you? Yeah, it looks all right. Thank you. Join us next week on Hot Not Pod. You have been listening to a
Kath, the edits would be so much easier if every episode was 7 minutes long. But I also suspect it would have absolutely no appeal whatsoever as content. So,
what, two people looking at a photograph on an auditory art
it's, it's actually, that is a joke in one of the episodes of Brass Eye, where they do an advert for a TV show that's just called Would You? And it's just Mark Heap in a caravan being shown pictures of women. You don't even see the pictures of the women. You just see like a hand come into frame with a picture, and Heap will say like, eh, maybe. It's very funny. Maybe this is in itself a comment on content culture, that a one-off gag in the Chris Morris show from the 90s, we have now decided is worthy of literally months and years of entertainment. We have expanded it into hours and hours of entertainment. Anyway, according to David Cassidy's J. Robert Oppenheimer and the American Century, J. Robert Oppenheimer was born into a non-practicing Jewish family in New York City on April 22nd, 1904. According to American Prometheus by Martin J. Sherwin and Kai Bird, his father Julius was born in what was then Prussia and came to the United States as a teenager in 1888 with few resources, no money, no baccalaureate studies, and no knowledge of the English language, and became a textile executive. According to Cassidy, the young Bobbio was super smart, completing third and fourth grades in 1 year and skipping half of the eighth grade. Kath, were you academic or were you cool? Did you bury your head in textbooks or in a 20-pack of Benson and Hedges behind the bike shed like a fucking legend?
I was. Guess. Which do you think I was?
20-pack of Benson and Hedges? Easily.
Now, sure. But then.
Well, I only know you now, and you've cultivated that leather jacket, go fuck yourself, I'm having a fag look. But maybe that wasn't the cath of the youth.
No, I was quite a quiet, bookish youth, to be honest, simply because I didn't have the social skills to be anything else. So I thought I'd just keep my head down, get through it, and then we'll be cool when we're older.
Who needs friends when you've got books?
What was your schooling experience, Ed?
I was very academic up until the age of about 12, and then it either got too hard or my attention span wavered. I got an E, 3 Ds, a C, a B, and 3 As in my GCSEs, which I think is an unusual pattern of grades. Most people's grades are clustered in one area, whereas I went for the full whack. I went into that GCSE exam and went, I want to try the whole platter, even if it fucks me in employment later in life.
I think the only thing weirder than the spreading of that grid is that as a 38-year-old man, you still remember what you got in your GCSEs.
Because it was so unusual. People didn't get such a weird grade results. Can you not remember? Is it not still top of your curriculum vitae, Kath?
No. I know I got 10 GCSEs.
Oh, you see, I'm the opposite. I can't remember how many I got. But I sort of roughly remember the grades.
I could barely tell what they were in, let alone what grades I got.
Okay, what was your best and your worst subject?
Science is my worst subject. I do remember my science teacher looking me in the eyes the day before the exam and begging me to revise. She said, just please, please just read the book. And I said, Miss. We both know I'm not going to do that. She sighed and walked away.
You see, Kath, I think this proves that you were a fucking legend. Because you just basically stuck two fingers up at the science teacher and said, I've got a 20-pack and it ain't going to smoke itself. Fuck you, lady.
Unsurprisingly, my best subject was history.
Yay! And to think people say that this is a history podcast hosted by two people who are unqualified. But I got a C in history, and you presumably got higher than a C in history.
What happened was, I think I might have got like an A or an A star or something.
Oh, I can't remember. It was generally in the A region.
Yeah. Well, no, I remember I got one A star, but I can't remember what it was in. But probably history. And then I was like, great, I'm going to do it at college. And when I got to college, there was a pub across the road from that college that would serve literally anyone. And yeah, I had to then drop history. Well, I was drunk all the time, Aidan.
You switched to an AS level and getting absolutely smashed. And that's what the A and the S stand for.
Yeah, I went hard.
In 1911, Oppenheimer joined the Ethical Culture Society School, which educated students in the Ethical Culture Movement, a movement which was a precursor to today's humanist movement. The central ideas of ethical culture are to respect every person's dignity and worth, to aim to elicit the best in others, and to encourage the best in people by blasting them with dozens of kilotons of explosive nuclear radiation. I may have made up that last bit. Bobby O majored in physics and graduated Harvard in 1925 with a Bachelor of Arts degree. His thermodynamics teacher, Percy Bridgman, recommended Bobby to Christ's College, Cambridge, but also noted his clumsiness in the laboratory and made it apparent his forte was theoretical, not experimental physics. That's not what you that's not what you want from the father of the bomb, is it? A known Butterfingers.
Butterfingers, Bobby.
You can imagine the headline. A right clumsy Colin destroys Cambridge in an atomic blast.
All of the southeast is gone due to Yank.
According to American Prometheus, Bobby O had an antagonistic relationship with his tutor, Patrick Blackett, once leaving an apple doused in noxious chemicals on Blackett's desk. It was only the lobbying of his parents that prevented Bobby O from being placed in an academic probation. Now, to be fair to young Oppenheimer, this could have been a lot worse. He could have pranked Blackett by leaving a box of Maltesers on his desk, but instead of Maltesers, they were actually each tiny enriched uranium spheres. That guy could have been shitting neon turds for a week.
That'd be awesome. I think I've been to that bar, Neon Turds. Get a neon stamp on the back of your hand that don't come off for a week.
It's annoying that as well, because you go into work or something the next day and people are like, oh, someone hasn't showered. It's like, I scrubbed my body for 20 minutes. This thing is not coming off. They've hennaed the entry pass onto the back of my hand.
Mm-hmm. It's weird because I have scrubbed the skin off my hand. And yet the stamp is still there.
You can just see it crossing each bit of bone leading to each finger.
It comes off when it comes off, all right.
According to Alice Kimball Smith and Charles Wiener's Robert Oppenheimer Letters and Recollections, Bobby O suffered bouts of depression and once told his brother, "I need physics more than friends." A bit like you and books when you were a teenager, Kaz. According to Wikipedia, in one bout of depression, he tried to strangle his friend Frances Ferguson after he revealed he was engaged to his girlfriend Frances Keeley.
That seems extreme.
According to Wikipedia, Oppenheimer obtained a Doctor of Philosophy degree in March 1927 at age 23. It was at this age he and his supervisor Max Born came up with the Born-Oppenheimer approximation, which separates nuclear motion from electronic motion in the mathematical treatment of molecules, allowing nuclear motion to be neglected to simplify calculations. I don't understand anything I just said, but that is what they did. We're going back to the D's and E's that we both got in GCSE physics. I'm just trusting Wikipedia on this one, and I'm just trusting that I got those words in roughly the right order.
It was like, you know when you're desperately trying to understand something, but all you can hear is TV static? I find science interesting, and I wish I could understand it. I really, really do. But I just can't.
I've genuinely read about three books on quantum physics in an attempt to understand it, and I just can't. I just can't get past the whole, oh yeah, these things, they act as waves, and they also act as photons. It's like, no, you've lost me. And that's like a fundamental thing you have to understand this stuff. and it is absolutely brilliant. That's why I like Doctor Who, because it's made up science. It doesn't mean anything. It's just words that sound fun when a man in a bow tie says it.
Wibbly wobbly timey wimey. Do you know what the crack is?
Yes, I can get on board with that. No problem.
According to Wikipedia, Oppenheimer was awarded a United States National Research Council Fellowship to Caltech in September 1927. There he became close friends with Linus Pauling, and the new BFFs decided to mount a joint attack on the nature of the chemical bond. It did not go to plan, with Oppenheimer instead mounting a unilateral attack on Pauling's marriage, inviting his wife Ava Pauling to join him on a Mexican tryst. Ava incidentally declined Bobby's advances, so from this, Bobby gained neither a sexual bond, a social bond, or a rewriting of the chemical bond. Incidentally, Oppenheimer later invited Pauling to become the head of the chemistry division of the Manhattan Project, but Pauling refused, saying he was a pacifist. And I assume by pacifist he means still pissed off that Oppenheimer tried to bang his wife 2 decades earlier. Robert, I am conscientiously objecting to you trying to stick it in, Mrs. Pauling.
Yeah, no, that is absolutely fair.
Kath, have you ever stolen a friend's lover?
No. No, I don't think I could have done it if I wanted to be honest.
Oh, because of your infamous lack of charisma?
Yeah, that, because of my looks and personality. That was that was the only reason. Also, I just, and this is no slight on any of my friends if they are listening to this, which they won't be, but I've just never seen a partner and been so attracted to them that I was like, I'm willing to lose this friendship over it.
It's a boner killer, isn't it? Or a quim closer in your case.
Yeah.
According to the early years, University of California, Berkeley, when he heard a New Mexico ranch he loved was available for lease, he exclaimed, "Hot dog!" Purchased it and later called it Perro Caliente, which literally means hot dog in Spanish. That's fun. That's what you want in the father of the most destructive force the world has ever seen. A little catchphrase. A fun little catchphrase that could appeal to kids. The nuclear bomb's gone off. Hot dog.
Can you imagine being the wife of a scientist and this guy coming over to you, Cillian Murphy, coming over to you, being like, hey, baby, wanna see my hot dog? And you're like, oh, that's quite a crude euphemism, but sure. And then he takes you back to a house. This is my hot dog. What?
Well, if it was
what the
you,
fuck are you on about? This is my hot dog. Do you want to see my dick?
If it was you though, Kath, when he said, "Hot dog, do you want to see my hot dog?" You'd go, "Yeah, sure, I guess." And then when you realised that was also the name of his house, you'd be like, "Well, you're quite hot, so." And then if his bed was in the shape of a hot, like a novelty hot dog bed, you'd probably stay. Even that, I don't think you'd stop you, Kath. I think you'd keep going. If he pulled out a contraceptive sheath that was a novelty condom in the shape of a hot dog in a bun, you'd probably still be like, "Well, I'm here now."
Yeah, I can't. He drove us here. So I can't get myself back, can I?
According to Janet Connett, in her book 109 East Palace, Bobby O said his favourite things were physics and the desert. I guess we would consider what he would later get up to in the desert. We're lucky his favourite things weren't physics and metropolitan sprawl. The headline would have been, "Trinity bomb tested in New York, Long Island, wiping out the populations of Brooklyn, Queens and the Hamptons." According to Greg Herkin, Brotherhood of the Bomb, his students and colleagues saw him as mesmerizing, hypnotic in private interaction, but often frigid in more public settings. His associates fell into two camps. One saw him as aloof and impressive genius, the other as a pretentious and insecure poser. According to Herkin, and also American Genius by Herbert Childs, he was largely uninformed on worldly matters and only learned of the 1929 Wall Street crash 6 months after the fact, which I think is quite funny. 9/11, or as I like to call it, 3/11, in honour of the day in March when I discovered the world had changed half a year ago.
But also, how nice to be that financially protected. That
yeah,
didn't know
that's a good point
about the Wall Street crash.
I reckon there must be people like that now, because you know some people just like to sort of hit a point where they're like, "I'm switching off these Guardian news alerts. This is too depressing."
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's what I've done.
You know there's a war on in Ukraine, Kath, or are you just happy to not know that?
What?
Yeah. It's been going on for like a year and a half now. It's fucking depressing.
Oh, damn. No, I know about things that happen, but yeah, it's just me knowing about it isn't going to make it any difference, is it? If I can help, tell me.
The only thing we can do really is not vote for twats.
Which I do, and they still
And
keep
still keep winning.
getting in.
Welcome to
Yeah,
England.
honestly, I think I should vote for them next time, and then they definitely won't get in.
I'm going to join you in that. Let's make a suicide pact. We vote for the Tories next time, and it's the only way to ensure they don't actually get elected.
Yes.
So Oppenheimer, Bobby O, he did become more engaged in world affairs in the 30s, which is encouraging. It's a good decade to get up on the news, I think, the 30s. If there's one decade of news you're not going to sit
It is, yeah.
out, make sure it's the one after the 20s and before the 40s. The rise of fascism was a wake-up call that even he couldn't sleep through. He donated the modern equivalent of £2,000 a month to help German physicists fleeing Nazism. And he tried to get an ex-student of his called Bob Serber a position at Berkeley, but was blocked on the grounds that one Jew in the department was enough.
Fuck.
Bring me your poor, your tired, and your Jews, but don't expect us to employ any of them.
Anti-Semitism was everywhere, wasn't it, in this period? It didn't just come out of nowhere. Like, you know, I think people in the UK like to be like, yeah, well, we went into the war to save Poland and the Jews. No, we didn't. People here were very anti-Semitic as well. They were in America pulling that shit. It wasn't a kind world. Still isn't.
I'm so big on this. Like, I think people born after the 60s, we have a post-civil rights, we see World War II through a prism of civil rights in a way that I don't think people at the time did. I do think people just had a slightly us versus them feeling about it. And I don't mean to underestimate, it was clear to intelligent people why someone like Hitler was a threat. But it is also true that people weren't going, we need to go there and save them Jews. Because actually, I don't think that's what people were thinking. And generational anti-Semitism, it's embedded in. It does tell, well, one, it hasn't fully gone anyway, as we know. But two, even if that did drop after World War II, anti-Semitism, it's not like it just suddenly disappears overnight. It takes decades to for society to change its attitudes on those kind of things.
It's very sad.
According to Cassidy, he would host fundraisers for the Republican cause in the Spanish Civil War and other anti-fascist activity, and identified himself as a fellow traveller, which he defined as someone who agrees with many of the goals of communism, but is not willing to blindly follow orders from any communist party apparatus. And that's going to become significant later when we get to the period after World War II, where he was nominally a national hero, but he came up against the Red Scare. According to the United States Atomic Energy Commission, in the matter of Dr. J. Robert Oppenheimer, he would sometimes admit to being a communist and also backtrack these statements as being jokes. Now, I don't know about you, Kath. I feel in the 1940s and 50s, joking about being a communist is a bit like being in an airport now and saying, I hope they don't detect my bomb. Don't worry, it's just a gag. Just don't make the gag. Don't make the gag. It's not worth the hassle. If you make the gag, you're not getting on the plane to Malaga. You're going back home to your bedsit in Leeds.
Exactly. That is a very bold joke to be making as a Jewish person in a job where they've already said, we don't really want you
Yeah,
here.
exactly.
Being a communist at that point wasn't quite as bad as it became to be a communist, right?
I think pre-war, absolutely that's the case. Because the USSR and communism and all that, it's still becoming an international force. I think one of the problems he had was he just associated with a lot of people who definitely were communists, avowed communists. And he was, as I say, sympathetic. But it's just kind of the case with a lot of like academic intelligentsia that you're associating those kinds of people, which becomes a problem in the Red Scare when they're trying to weed out these people. And actually, quite a lot of people, including people who have no guilt, especially in terms of international espionage, like Oppenheimer, are sort of being implicated in this stuff because you can, of course, tie him to very left-wing sympathies. But that in itself is not a crime. But that is getting ahead of ourselves. We will get into that. According to Leslie Groves, Now It Can Be Told, the story of the Manhattan Project, despite communist associations and suspicious behavior, the director of the Manhattan Project felt Bobby was absolutely essential to the project and protected him from being ousted.
That was probably a poor call, wasn't it? I mean, he was good at the job. That's kind of the problem.
Why is that a poor call?
Well, I mean, I guess the bomb would still exist, right?
But then that is an interesting question. Nuclear warfare is bad. Hot take. Hot take alert. the hot take siren's just gone off. Mm-hmm. But I do think, though, and I'm curious to know what you think, if you know the Nazis are also trying to create a nuclear bomb, do you try and create a nuclear bomb? It's an open and shut legs, right? You've got to do it if you think the Nazis might beat you to it.
Yeah. But
you can't be blasé about Nazis with a fucking nuke.
I guess that's the thing, isn't it? I always thought that in an argument, you need to go as hard as you can immediately. Because if you try and build it up a little bit and a little bit and a little bit, then you become desensitized to it, don't you? But if, for example, your neighbour sort of slightly bumps a wing mirror as they're pulling out, just set their lawn on fire. And that sends a message.
Nuke their fucking house. You don't seem that active on Twitter. But the fact that you said, oh, when you're having an argument, go in as hard as possible straight away. Kath, you would do very well on Twitter if that's your attitude to the world. They fucking love maximalism right from the outset of the debate. That's Twitter in a nutshell.
So personally, if I was a scientist, I would have simply developed a nuclear bomb during World War One. When everyone was still being transported on horseback. And, you know, the best that they got was, let's dig a hole and sit in it for 4 years. And then I would just be like, okay, bomb that country. That's what you want. You want something bigger than that. If you find out that the opposition is doing the nuclear bomb, you'd be like, okay, well, I'm going to do a bomb that will destroy your entire country and all of your descendants that aren't even in that country.
I'm so glad you failed your science A level. This is your GCSEs, if this is your attitude.
Is this what you can do?
I'm happy that you're no more qualified to be in charge of anything other than a sex-themed history podcast.
The thing is, right, I say this stuff and then I forget. I'm one super buck in. Lidl are selling Superbock, Portugal's finest.
Yeah, he's back on the Superbock.
Yeah, so I'm a Superbock in. I'm feeling quite fruity. And I just answer your questions as honestly as I can do. And I never think about it again. You listen to this and edit it. And then other people listen to it. And then they get in touch with me and they're like, Catherine, I think that was a bit unfair, the thing that you said in episode 4 of season 2. And I'm like, I don't fucking know. I don't remember what I had for breakfast.
Kath, in that Oppenheimer episode where you said you'd have gladly nuked Germany in 1918 if you had the bloody chance, that may have been a bit strong. A lot of people thought the Treaty of Versailles was too harsh. Kath's like, no, not far enough. Develop the world's most destructive bomb and drop it on Germany so that they can't even make the reparations.
I obviously don't mean this. You all know that, right? You know that I'm not.
They don't know this, Kath.
No. Well, I've told
every episode has new listeners, Kath. I've seen the stats. Every episode has new listeners.
Okay,
some people think this is you, and they're not coming to your Edinburgh show anymore.
Oh no! I advocate peace, and I hope that in my sincere moments, my wokeness shines through.
Do you know what's funny? When I asked the question about do you develop the bomb if you know the Nazis are, I thought it might start, like it might be an interesting conversation between someone who's slightly more centrist on that and someone who's slightly more pacifist. Nope, you just went way further than anyone could have possibly have gone on that debate. Bobby O impregnated Kitty Puning, the wife of medical researcher Richard Harrison, leading to the end of their marriage and the start of a new one between Oppenheimer and Kitty. He had on-off affairs with Jean Tatlock, a psychiatrist, physician and member of the Communist Party of the USA, which caused him further security clearance issues. According to American Prometheus, he was also banging Ruth Tolman, the wife of his friend Richard Tolman. This guy, Kath, he split open the atom and he also split open people's wives. That's what he did.
Do you think that he knew that single people existed and that he doesn't just have to fuck his mate's wives? Robert, you could just... We've got speed dating on Thursday, Robert. Do you want to come with us? No. Fuck me.
There's literally a Caltech singles club. Let's just go to the Caltech singles club. It's like, no. I literally can't get an erection unless I've destroyed someone's marriage. So this is the way I'm going to operate for the rest of my life.
Yeah, okay. Well, why don't you just go on the dating apps then and do it? No, it's got to be somebody's wife that I know personally.
This guy's kink is the tears of his male colleagues. Let's not kink shame. If he wants to fuck other guys' wives, let's not kink shame him for
No, I think we can shame him for it.
that.
I think that is morally wrong.
According to a book called Critical Assembly, A Technical History of Los Alamos, one of his first acts after being hired for the Manhattan Project, which was, of course, the American attempt to develop an atomic bomb, was to host a summer school for bomb theory at his building in Berkeley. Hey, Susie, what extracurricular classes are you taking? Oh, well, I'm taking Netball, Baking 101, and Introduction to Nuclear Detonations.
Can you imagine having that now? Like, if you Google how to make a bomb, the police will be at your door. Can you imagine having that on your CV now, trying to get through an airport?
Well, I was going to do the knitting class, but it was full, so I just decided to take the advanced hydrothermal nuclear explosion class. What can I do?
Yeah. Bomb making it'll be then.
According to American Prometheus, despite his lack of a Nobel Prize, Oppenheimer was put in charge of the project's secret weapons laboratory due to his knowledge in several fields, including physics, chemistry, metallurgy, ordnance and engineering. Looking for a secret remote location for the laboratory, Oppenheimer picked a location in New Mexico, not far from his ranch. Again, good job he wasn't living in an urban sprawl. Where shall we test this bomb? How about Croydon? Because I live in Tooting.
Yeah, there's a bus. As long as there's a bus that'll get me there,
Yeah.
fine.
The American government will fund you going anywhere. No, I want to get home in time for Pointless, so I'd really like to be quite close to my house if we're going to do
Yeah.
this.
You know what though? Some people get criticised for being NIMBY, you know, not in my backyard. But he's like, no, please, in
And
my
he's not.
backyard.
And this is about as nimby as it gets. He's going to destroy the entire outside environment near his house. His house price is going to fucking plummet after this.
Nobody's not going to buy the hot dog.
According to Victor Weisskopf, Oppenheimer was intellectually and physically present at each decisive step of the Manhattan Project. He was present in the laboratory or in the seminar rooms when a new effect was measured, when a new idea was conceived. It was not that he contributed so many ideas or suggestions. He did so sometimes, but his main influence came from something else. It was his continuous and intense presence, which produced a sense of direct participation in all of us. It created that unique atmosphere of enthusiasm and challenge that pervaded the place throughout its time. Oppenheimer was fascinated with Hindu literature, and the Trinity Test explosion at Los Alamos reminded him of passages from Bhagavad Gita, notably, "I am become death, the destroyer of worlds." I suppose the reason other events didn't remind him of the Bhagavad Gita is that there wasn't a passage that reads, "I have become fuckboy, stealer of men's wives."
But also that, yes. Imagine being that guy. You must be there, like going, you know what? I am developing a bomb. What other bad shit can I do? I'm gonna break up
Yeah.
17 marriages too.
I'm going to break up every marital union in a 10-mile radius. Incidentally, that is the blast radius of the bomb that I am trying to make.
And also my blast radius, if you will. Hey.
Cox.
According to Jeremy Bernstein, letters bomb in the head. When Bernstein asked Frank Oppenheimer, Robert's brother, what Robert's first words were after the test had been, the answer was, "I guess it worked." Which is an understatement. That's like watching the Hindenburg disaster and saying, "I think it's getting a bit warm." Or watching the Hindenburg disaster or the nuclear Trinity test and going, "Hot dog." He totally should have said
Yeah,
hot dog, shouldn't he?
I hope he said hot dog.
What would you say after a successful nuclear test, Kath?
Probably what I always say. Fucking hell. That's my catchphrase.
Fucking hell without a G because you're from the north. I'm going to edit a G back into anything you say then.
Okay, hold on. Let me just include it here and then you can use it. Go. There you go.
Yeah, there you go. And that will allow me to Pygmalion you later. Part of the reason I'm doing the Oppenheimer episode, as I'm sure many of you have already noticed, there was a film about Oppenheimer coming out on July
No
21st by Christopher Nolan. This is a tie-in, not an
way.
official tie-in, just a cynical attempt by me to ride some of the social media and hashtag waves that are being generated by the nuclear blast of that film's $100 million promotional campaign. There actually is a bit in the trailer for this film, which we haven't seen. There is a bit in the trailer where you see people smearing white stuff on their face. I don't know if it's sun cream or something, but I like the idea of the scientists testing the first nuclear bomb going, I'm just going to put some factor 20 on. And Oppenheimer's like, you might need something a little bit bigger. If anything, I'd go for that really sensitive 50-plus stuff they use for toddlers. This is going to be pretty hot. According to Ray Monk's book, Robert Oppenheimer, A Life in the Center, Oppenheimer and his staff were sad about the Nagasaki bombing, as they did not feel a second bomb was necessary from a military point of view. Kath, do you think the bombing of Hiroshima and Nagasaki was necessary? And I want to remind you, this is a comedy podcast, so keep the answer light and funny.
Oh, I'm not good at that, am I? I always get dark and heavy immediately. No, I mean, I think we probably shouldn't kill vast swathes of civilians for arguably no good reason. I mean, we were done with the war, weren't we, at that point, really? So it makes no difference to us, but it's just very American, isn't it? I can't see Britain at that point doing that. I think Britain would be like, well, it's the gentlemanly thing to do to carry on this war for 2 years.
Oh, yeah, the British would have carried on World War II to about 1948, just out of sheer awkwardness.
Whereas the Americans are like, no, it's fine. We'll just destroy everything. Just burn it all. What do you mean? All of it. What do you mean, all of it? You know.
Just the entire southern peninsula of Japan. Just all of that.
Yeah, what's the problem with that? I don't see what the problem is with that. Set it on fire, it's okay.
I get what the thinking was, which is more soldiers would die if you had a land invasion. And I don't want to be flippant about soldiers' lives, but soldiers do sign up to give their lives for war in a way civilians don't, which is why I don't think they should have dropped it.
Yeah, I mean, arguably.
It's a massive war crime, is what I'm saying.
Yeah, it was absolutely a war crime, and the only reason they didn't get punished for it is because they won. These soldiers, they'd hardly decided that they were going to volunteer for it, right? Because of conscription and shit. But yeah, I mean, I think even as a soldier, you're an adult with a gun who's better able to defend themselves than a child with fire raining from the sky. Yeah.
Well, you like this next bit. According to Monk and American Prometheus, Bobby O confronted President Truman about the situation, complaining that he had blood on his hands, which isn't true. He more likely had those shadows that nuclear explosions cast against the walls on his hands.
If he's complaining about having blood on his hands, what the fuck did he think he was working on? We're going to make this... You're making a bomb. Jesus Christ. It's not a confetti cannon, is it?
It's just a T-shirt cannon that blasts loads of I Love USA T-shirts at the populations of Hiroshima and Nagasaki. Yeah, this will end the war.
Splitting an atom. How can you imagine how powerful that T-shirt cannon would be? An atom to fire. Just leave a hole through your middle, wouldn't it?
I think he's objecting to the Nagasaki bombing because he felt that was taking it too far. I mean, it is also true that the Japanese didn't surrender after the Hiroshima initially because they genuinely didn't believe it had happened. They were being told, oh, Hiroshima doesn't exist. And the government were like, that's stupid. Of course it exists. I know what you mean, though, Kath. Like, he was making the bomb, you know. It's like Jesus said, if you don't want blood on your hands, wear gloves while performing surgical operations.
Yep, he did say that.
Kath, what's the worst thing you've ever got on your hands? 140,000 dead Japanese people or just a dead Salford comedy club on a Saturday night?
I've worked in catering, so I've had all sorts of shit on my hands. Oh my God. Once, right, I worked at a movie premiere. I was a waitress in a movie premiere, and I'll not say what movie premiere it was, but it did have three X's in the title. I'll let you work that one out. It got to the end of the night, and I was emptying this big ice box that got beers in it, and I was, you know, like up to my elbows in what, like just ice and shit, just pulling these drinks out. And it slowly dawned on me that someone had, at some point that evening, vomited into the icebox. And I was just, like, elbow deep in vom and ice. So that's the thing that I can bring to mind. But I've worked with kids. I've worked in catering. I have had unthinkable shit on my hands. And actual shit.
I think we've got a similar backstory to that. I worked briefly in care. So the worst thing I've had on my hands is human shit and not my own. Mm-hmm. I don't mean metaphorical human shit like the failings of the Homo sapien race. I mean poo. I mean poo that came out of someone else's bum, not mine, and ended up on my hands and that I then had to scrub off. I'd rather have that than blood. I mean, it's disgusting. I think I'd rather have poo on my hands than blood. Because if you've got blood on your hands, it's probably your fault. If you've got poo on your hands, it probably isn't, unless it's your own. As Christ himself once said, according to American Prometheus, the Manhattan Project was top secret and did not become public knowledge until after the bombings of Hiroshima and Nagasaki. I mean, destroying the architecture and population of two major cities will let the cat out of the bag on that front.
Yeah, you're not keeping that one quiet, are you?
Post-war, Bobby O strongly influenced the Akerson-Lilienthal report, which advocated the collection of atomic energy for peaceful use. This report was largely reshaped into the Barak Plan, which attempted to protect the American monopoly on nuclear power. These events convinced Oppenheimer that the nuclear arms race was unavoidable. According to American Prometheus and Superbomb by Warner R. Schilling and Ken Yeung, Oppenheimer argued against the development of more powerful bombs, such as a thermonuclear hydrogen bomb, on the grounds that in peacetime they weren't necessary. Kath, I feel like Oppenheimer's post-war career is a bit like if this podcast became a big hit, and then we immediately became advocates for the control and limited deployment of cock and fanny jokes. It feels like maybe there'd be a bit of hypocrisy there.
It feels weird that he is against the thing that he created. If anybody knew how powerful that thing would be, it's the scientist that's fucking making it, right?
I have some sympathy, because I do think if the Nazis attempted to do it, you have to do it. But yeah, I know what you mean. I suppose he seems to be coming from a, if you have to drop it once and be done with it.
But Aidan, the Nazis were doing a whole load of stuff. Yeah, you don't have to copy everyone.
Oh, if the Nazis jumped off a cliff, would you do it, eh?
Yeah, exactly. Maybe it'd be for the best if you all just jumped off a bloody cliff.
We have to beat the Nazis in the cliff jumping race, otherwise who knows what they'll do? In the 1950s, at the height of McCarthyism, Bobby O had his security clearance revoked after the chair of the United States Atomic Energy Commission, Louis Strauss, led hearings which investigated Oppenheimer's ties to communism. According to Wikipedia, the panel found that he was loyal and discreet with atomic secrets, but did not recommend that his security clearance be reinstated, which is so 1950s America. Well, he's not guilty, but let's just pretend that he was, because that's what our emotions tell us he was, even though the facts are not telling us that.
Yeah.
According to Wikipedia, he was rehabilitated in the 60s under the Kennedy administration, being awarded the Enrico Fermi Award. France made him an officer of the Legion of Honour, and he was elected a foreign member of the Royal Society in Britain. According to the New York Times, in 2022, the US Secretary of Energy, Jennifer Granholm, nullified the 1954 decision, saying that it had been the result of a flawed process, and affirmed that Oppenheimer had been loyal. Again, I feel like calling the McCarthyite witch hunts of the 1950s a flawed process is a bit of an understatement, when really it was an absolute shit show. It was a shit show so large, it was like a circus was coming to town in which the only things on display were large turds.
I think as well, what I adore is that blokes are like, we're not emotional, we don't get emotional. So that hysteria there was not created by men, and anger isn't an emotion.
Exactly.
But if you'd have told any one of them, if you'd have gone, oi, McCarthy, you're being hysterical, he'd have been like, how dare you? Men can't be hysterical.
A woman cries over a miscarriage and, oh, women are just basically hysterical and not in control of emotions. But us men, for centuries, we've been holding the line emotionally. Does that explain all those wars and all those witch hunts?
We don't cause drama. Oh, you mean apart from everything that has ever happened?
An Another chain reaction that Oppenheim was a fan of was the reaction his body had to chain smoking, which resulted in him dying of throat cancer after failed chemotherapy in 1967. Kath, we have reached the end of this here episode. Would you ban, knowing what he looks like and what he did, would you ban serial wife fucker and nuclear bomb creator J. Robert Oppenheimer?
See, the thing is, I don't know if I could because I'm not married. He'd be more into you than me at the minute.
He'd be more into my wife. I'm not taking my wife near his grave. Fuck that. If I took my wife near his grave, his hand would probably shoot out the ground like Carrie at the end of Carrie.
Up a skirt. Oh, like a Halloween decoration. God, I don't know. Because you have to differentiate between, is it a bang? Is it a relationship? Because absolutely not, looking at his track record, if you go into a relationship with this man, because he will cheat on you. He's already cheating on you, no matter what stage of your relationship you're in. So, I mean, no to a relationship.
Do you reckon some women are attracted to that? Because in the same way
I think so.
Known players do attract women. Is that because women are thinking, well, he's probably good in bed if he's getting all these women?
Yeah, I think it's because they know what they're doing. Like, a player will know how to get you, how to be nice and get you to a position where you're like, yeah, all right then, that's their job. And also, yeah, I mean, I guess there's a certain element of, well, you'd hope that at least this one would know where the clit is, wouldn't you?
Say what you want about Hiroshima, Oppenheimer knew where the G-spot was.
And there is nothing more disappointing than a bloke who's all like, yeah, I've fucked loads. And you're like, and you're still shit at it. That's embarrassing.
Based on that logic, Kath, we don't actually know if he was good in bed. So are you going to take the chance?
No. I'm going to say no, because I feel like he is generic enough looking. Like, he's not hot enough to overcome the amount of character flaws he's got.
Whereas with Roosevelt a couple of weeks ago, you felt he was hot enough in his youth to overcome a massive myriad of character flaws. Whereas this guy's like, it's not quite there. Doesn't quite tip it over the edge.
Yeah. Honestly, I think I'm not a massive fan of cheating or infidelity. It doesn't sit right with me. You know?
You're so woke. What's wrong with you?
I know. I mean, fuck the two major cities that were flattened. I don't like cheating.
It's got nothing to do with what happened in Japan. You're just like, adultery? No.
You could just not, right? And no one gets it.
He's a man in a position of power that's probably attractive to some young women. So there's got to be some power thing going on there. Like,
100%, yeah.
If you can steal a man's wife, it's like the biggest proof of his ladness.
Would you fuck him?
I think I would. This is going to sound sad. Out of some kind of intellectual respect for the man, I think I am drawn to his weird intensity.
Yeah.
Just out of shallow academic respect, I was going to say I'd stick it in him. Let's face it, he's going to stick it in me. He's going to be the giver in this situation.
Yeah, 100%.
I want to feel how wide that blast radius is.
Oh, God.
It was your decision, so we're not putting him on the biotech baptistry. Thanks for listening, folks. This is an unofficial cross-promotion with Oppenheimer. Maybe go and watch Oppenheimer. Thanks for listening, everybody.
Spread the word. Spread your legs.
And remember,
not what's on the outside, it's what's on the inside of the coffin that counts.
See you next week, everybody.
You have been listening to Historical Hot or Not, written and created by Aidan McCaffrey and Catherine Mather. The podcast art was by our good friend Richard Todd, and our theme music by excellent musician and also good friend David Eagle. We also have music by Ergo Fismas, letter license from the Free Music Archive. If you've enjoyed us and you'd like to donate to the cause, we would love you to do that also. You can find us at ko-fi.com/hotnotpod, and you can download bonus episodes of Historical Hot or Not from Acast Plus. The link is available on our Linktree, linktree.com/hotnotpod. Bye!